KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Today, I'm excited to have on the show Ron Epstein, the CEO of Epicenter IP. Ron is someone who, and this is why I love flying anywhere to or near Silicon Valley, because I always meet interesting people on the plane. So I met Ron on a flight, I think either to or from Silicon Valley within the last year, and it was a fortuitous meeting because Ron runs a business called Epicenter IP, which is an entity that is connected to activities which are known in the patent law world as either non-practicing entities, which is a one descriptive term, or patent trolls, which is another. And so we are going to be discussing non-practicing entities and Ron's experience working for and in entities that are connected with this activity on today's show. So what is, of course, a non-practicing entity? For those, and I'll have Ron discuss it in more detail in a moment, but to introduce the topic, non-practicing entities or patent trolls are, in the simplest sense, entities that acquire patents that have been issued to others, and then those entities either license those patents or sell those patents to someone else, or perhaps even on other occasions are involved in seeing that those patents and the inventions that are contained in those patents are brought to market. No matter how you describe the activity, non-practicing entities, and I'll use that phrase for today's discussion, although I'll invite Ron to define the term and use the term that he chooses, are very controversial because they are viewed by some as subverting the incentives that are around the patent system, the notion being that patents are issued to inventors, and that non-practicing entities, by definitions, are not inventors. They purchase patent portfolios or individual patents, and that they are a drain on the system because non-practicing entities exist, and this is one view, merely to bring litigation, that is, patent infringement lawsuits, which therefore collect rents and damages and what have you from others that are being productive. That's one view. Another view of non-practicing entities is that they are, like any other market actor, entities that acquire assets and that use those assets for commercial gain. And that commercial gain may also include actually innovative policies and procedures and activities that can lead to products coming to market or improvement on existing inventions or research and development and so forth. Non-practicing entities are ramped up more broadly in the challenges that have been associated with regulating patents over the last 15 or 20 years. The American Invents Act, or which is also known as patent reform, of last year was designed to address some of these issues, but even today, and as we are recording today on July 8th, 2013, for airing July 10th, there are discussions in Congress and in the White House regarding legislation that would address non-practicing entities. Non-practicing entities have been a subject of Hearsay Culture interviews a few times over the last several years, most recently with Professor Mike Risch at Villanova, who did an interesting study of what or who patent trolls are. It's also a topic that continually comes up in even increasingly in popular commentary on intellectual property law. But today, having someone like Ron, who has more than 20 years' experience in developing, optimizing, and transacting intellectual property assets, according to the Epicenter websites, we are dealing with one of the top people in the field and someone whose insights are incredibly valuable. Ron is recognized as one of the people you go to for this kind of work. He's been both not only in practice, but also a speaker at a number of panels and conversations involving the patent system. Prior to founding Epicenter IP, he was with Brocade Communications. He was also the director of licensing at Intel. He has a Bachelor of Science from Duke and a JD from Berkeley. And he is joining us via Skype from his office in Redwood City, California, right there in Silicon Valley. So, Ron, without any further introduction, thank you much for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Well, I appreciate you for having me.
Ron, let's start off with a question I ask most of my guests, and I think it's a good one to ask here. Tell us a bit more about your background and how you got into this area, and through that you can tell us a bit about Epicenter IP.
Sure. You know, I got into intellectual property law in part because when I graduated from law school at UC Berkeley in the late 80s, the popular things to do were toxic torts and and corporate M&A law, but being so close to Silicon Valley and having a science undergraduate degree, I was more fascinated by what was going on down in Silicon Valley and how could I use my legal background to get involved there. And so I started actually as a lawyer. I tell my friends that I'm a recovering lawyer now, but I did start my career at a law firm in Silicon Valley named Wilson Sonsini Goodrich and Rosati, which those of us who are alums like to refer to it as the McKinsey of Silicon Valley, if you will. At one point, at the point I was there, I think they represented as much as 50% of all startups being formed in Silicon Valley. And I was in what was called the Technology Transactions Group. So this is the business law area of Silicon Valley. We were the guys who, who drafted and negotiated the terms and conditions of those shrink wrap license agreements that used to annoy you, the business agreements between companies to share technology, the creation of joint ventures. These were the kinds of things we did. But I got adopted pretty early on in my career as settlement guy by the patent litigation group. So. One of the outcomes of innovation, particularly where lots of people are spending lots of R&D dollars in very similar places, is that from time to time they believe they're copying each other, and you end up with things like patent infringement lawsuits. I ended up being adopted by the litigation department as the guy who, after the lawyers were done yelling at each other long enough, got thrown into the meeting to try and see if we could reach an agreed settlement. And this was this led to what we called at Wilson our patent laundry practice. By that I mean we representing as we did 50% or so of all startups. We had an awful lot of clients who were being approached by the IBMs, the Texas Instruments, the Intels, the AT&Ts, which became Lucent and is now AT&T again. We were being approached by those companies and asked to take licenses to the patented technology those large companies had developed. And so it was my job to represent the small companies in trying to minimize, if not actually successfully avoid, paying royalties to these large operating companies, which was a great job. I think at one point I counted that I had negotiated with IBM on behalf of 20 different clients here in Silicon Valley. Well, what happens when you get a lot of experience in that space is eventually I got the call from Intel brought on board to try and close all the loopholes in their patent licensing program that previously I had been assisting small companies in driving trucks through. And I spent 6 years at Intel from 1995 to 2001 running patent licensing, which involved first of all making the world safe for Intel microprocessors, a fancy way of saying defensive licensing. So if people believed they had patents that read on Intel's products, the first people they would talk to at Intel would be me or my group. The second thing that we owned, or I owned, was giving everybody in the world an opportunity to pay a fair amount in return for the use of Intel's patented technology, a really long-winded way of saying getting economic return on Intel's patents. And then the third thing I owned was anything else you could do that's clever with a patent that would improve shareholder value. So amongst the things that came out of my group was in the late 90s, I created Intel's patent purchasing program, which at the time was the first ever dedicated patent purchasing program in the tech industry. Why do I tell you all this? Well, bottom line is what I do at Epicenter today is I provide the same kind of services that I and my group at Intel did. We provide those services not to the Intel shareholders, but to everyone else. So while companies like Intel and IBM and Texas Instruments and AT&T and Microsoft and Apple, Google can afford large staffs of experienced and trained people to execute on patent licensing and patent monetization activities, most patent holders, and by that I mean pretty much any corporation doing less than $10 billion a year in revenue plus all individuals, I'm providing the same level of expertise those large corporations have to everyone else. That's the bottom line.
And so that for the uninitiated, to be clear, although I think that was pretty clear, when we use the phrase market maker in the context of what you do, what does that mean?
The stock markets exist as a market maker, meaning the ability of putting buyers and sellers together. And, you know, in a market like stock market, there already are interested buyers and interested sellers. So the major job of a market maker there is to just make sure you get the buyers and sellers together. In a market like patents, patent licensing, where you don't necessarily have interested buyers, only interested sellers, you have this additional job of not just putting buyers and sellers together, but also assisting the seller in making the sales case, if you will, to the buyer on why they would want to take that license. So or buy that patent. So we take not just a introduction job, we also have a marketing job along with that.
And how big is Epicenter in terms of numbers, employees, and assets that you're dealing with?
So over the history of the company, Epicenter IP Group and its predecessor, iPotential, we've done over $400 million worth of patent sales transactions. And we've done over, I guess you could count in some ways, if you do, over $1 billion worth of licensing transactions. In addition to doing strategic consulting and other things like that. So we act as we've done over 120-odd patent sales. We've done dozens of patent license agreements or patent license negotiations on behalf of our clients. Now, we're not a giant organization. There are six or seven of us, depending on the week, full-time here at Epicenter. Although to be successful, we've adopted a bit of a virtual corporation model, meaning we've got dozens of technical experts, university professors, engineers, and the like, who we have on retainer to assist us in deeply understanding the technology side of things. What we have here at Epicenter are people who understand the IP market and how to communicate in that.
We're chatting with Ron Epstein of Epicenter IP on KCSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Ron, so I'm going to I've defined patents. I want to make sure that listeners that are tuning in and are hearing the word patent don't immediately change the station because they don't know what a patent is. There are plenty of other listeners who know patents quite well, but for the benefit of those that aren't familiar, and it's always fun to ask anyway, even a basic question, in a minute or so, give me your broad definition of what a patent is.
Well, patent is basically a monopoly granted by the U.S. government. Or, you know, other national governments, a monopoly which allows the inventor to exclude others from practicing the invention in return for the inventor bringing the invention, disclosing the invention to the public. So the deal, the fundamental underlying deal is, please assist in the development of technology by not keeping your invention as a trade secret, instead to disclose it as broadly as possible, so that other people can build on top of that, in return for which we'll give you this province to exclude others from using that invention without your permission. So it's a bit of, you know, there's obviously an incentive system associated with that, an implied or assumed incentive system, which is, as the inventor and who has a right to exclude, you should have some ability to monetize that. Now note, patents do not give you the right to practice an invention, only to exclude others. Mm-hmm. And so patents end up having value only within the context of an exclusion discussion, which I'm sure we'll get into as we talk about NPEs.
Absolutely, and that really is the next question. So I used the phrase NPEs, or non-practicing entities, in my introduction, but now I'll ask you, what is an NPE?
Look. I don't get into I try to avoid getting into the definitions of various and sundry pejoratives. You know, just to give you a little background, sure. I was one of the four guys in the room at Intel when we made up the name Patent Troll, and we made it up as a specific conscious pejorative to make people feel bad about asserting patents against us, notwithstanding, without relationship as to whether they were in fact the inventor or, you know, they had a good patent. It was a pejorative to affect underlying emotion, and I'll tell you where the name came from.
Yeah.
We at Intel, my boss at the time, had accused a famous lawyer in the United States of being a patent terrorist, and that lawyer, not surprisingly, sued the company and my boss for defamation or one of those torts, and Intel agreed to no longer use the term patent terrorist, but we needed some pejorative to use instead of that. So we ended up having a contest in the Intel legal department. Winner got a $100 gift certificate to go to a restaurant here in Silicon Valley called Burke's, which was located around the corner from Intel's headquarters. And this is back when $100 would buy a couple dinner and a nice bottle of wine. Mm-hmm. And the contest was come up with a name that we can use against those who are asserting patents against Intel. Originally, the thought was that don't have their own business that we can assert patents back against. But really, it was to make people feel bad about patent assertion. So the winner was this woman, Ann Gundelfinger, who was the head of trademarks and brands, and her husband, Mark Davis. They walked away with the dinner certificate. My suggestion was patent pirate. In the end, I even voted for patent troll as a much cuter name.
Right.
So bottom line is, I don't know that the distinction has any value other than one as an emotional disincentive for those who are inventors to either themselves enforce or get access to financial support in enforcing their patents.
So Lee, understanding that the term itself is generally used in a pejorative way, but perhaps I'll ask you a question slightly differently, although you can
sure.
feel free to not answer it. The question is really this: if we parse the term non-practicing entity, right? I think the pejorative is the notion that the entity owning the patent is not actually doing anything with it. Now, as you point out, a patent only gives you the right to stop others from using whatever is claimed in the patent. In other words, whatever the patent says it invents. So from that perspective, if we put aside any pejorative labeling that exists with regard to non-practice entity, is it accurate to say that what Epicenter IP does, or even more broadly, what those that are labeled as not practicing entities do, is in fact that is not practicing the invention?
Well, look, there's nothing, I mean, the very concept, non-practicing entity, creates an implication that you're obligated to practice
right.
in order for your invention to be valuable, meaning that, if you don't practice the invention, then people are free to steal from you. Let's pull back a second and take a look at the underlying innovation market in a way that I think will be illustrative to answer your question. So the way I like to share this with people is, for companies here in the tech industry, let's just make up a company, Smartphone Co. Smartphone Co. has to introduce a new product every 6 months to 18 months that has new features and new functions versus the last product they introduced. Right, so we call this the integration pyramid. Every 6 to 18 months, new product comes out, has new features and functions. Where do those features and functions come from? There are three sources that those innovations come from. The first source is internal R&D. That is Smartphone Co.'s own development efforts, its own innovation efforts. Okay, By far, the smallest source of innovation for any product company is its own internal R&D efforts. And people usually stop me here and go, well, how can that be? And let me just give you an example.
Thanks.
And not to pick on Apple, but let's talk about the iPhone. The day before the iPhone was introduced, there were cell phones. They did have touch screens. There were app stores. They did have, Wi-Fi. They did have USB. They did operate on the radio signals. The only thing, or let's not minimize it, the thing that Apple brought to the table that was phenomenal and a market winner was a user interface and an ability to the interaction of the user with the phone. The underlying technology, for the most part, pre-existed Apple in a big way. Well, where did that technology come from? Other places, right? So One source is internal R&D. Second source is what I'll call participant inventors. Participant inventors are people like your competitors, your suppliers, your customers, other people spending large amounts of R&D dollars on essentially the same technological area, not surprisingly, will come up with things that you may want to look at. And again, we need to look no farther than the smartphone wars to see how rapidly the various manufacturers, let's just say, are influenced by the innovations coming out from their competitors.
Mm-hmm.
The third source, and this is getting at your question, the third source of innovation are what I call non-participating inventors or innovators. Non-participating innovators are an interesting crowd. One element of that crowd are universities, like, you know, obviously Stanford and Elon and Duke, my alma mater. Lots of these entities never seek to participate in the marketplace. So by definition, they're non-participating innovators. But in addition, here in Silicon Valley, most people don't think about this, but, you know, almost every startup ends up failing. What do I mean? So when I was a young lawyer at Wilson Sonsini, there were various tracking of new startups in the tech industry, and I remember there being a number of anywhere between 2,000 and 3,000 new startups in Silicon Valley in the tech industry every year back in the early 90s. Let's assume that's a fair number going forward. Through my 22-year career, that means there's been somewhere between, 20,000 and somewhere between 50 and 60,000 mm-hmm. startups. If you go to the Tech 1000, the 1,000th largest tech company is making a couple million dollars a year. So where's the other 59,000? Where did they go, mm-hmm. right? And the answer is, and by the way, these are not companies trying to invent the newest screw-top cap on top of a water bottle. These are guys and gals companies trying to put major new innovations on the table. And the answer is that an awful lot of them don't succeed for reasons that have nothing to do with the quality of their innovation.
Mm-hmm.
To be successful, you have to innovate, bring a team together, get funding, design a product, develop a product, manufacture a product, market a product, sell a product, support that product. So innovation is only one of multiple steps, and not surprisingly, large entities which possess all the capital resources necessary to do all those eight steps tend to be more successful at bringing innovation to the market than actual, you know, these new cutting-edge innovators. And,
mm-hmm.
and so when we talk about non-practicing entities and the non-practicing element of it, I honestly don't really understand what that means or why that's a relevant inquiry, meaning that the relevant inquiry is, are you an innovator, yes or no? Did you provide that innovation to the marketplace, and are you entitled to a return on the investment you made in that innovation, regardless of whether or not you were any good at or were successful at competing with much larger companies at attracting capital, team, access to markets, and all the other things that are necessary to bring a product to market.
So let's and we're going to take a break in a couple of minutes, Ron. But with that jumping up off point, you know, let's get into that a bit. And I'll ask you really the tough question, or the big question, and then we can kind of break it down a bit. So as I mentioned in the introduction, and as you know, non-practicing entities, and I'll use that phrase for a moment. Although really, my question partially is, what should I call Epicenter IP? And perhaps the answer is I should call you another patent owner. But I'll let you get to that in a moment. But more broadly, you know, I think the primary criticism of NPEs is this notion that they exist merely to sue. And so without loading the dice any further, I'll ask you that question along with that, the question of, if you're not an NPE, what should we call you?
Well, fair enough. I mean, we've alluded to this before. The distinction of calling somebody a non-practicing entity because they're or worried about the question of whether or not they exist merely to sue, you know, bottom line is, as we discussed before, patents solely give you a right to exclude. So what does that mean? That means to the extent that someone is using your patented invention, the only dynamic. The only question you're having in a negotiation is, can I keep you from doing that? Or what will you pay me in return for me giving up my right ultimately to exclude? So let me give you an example. Going back to those three categories that I gave you a second ago, the internal R&D, we know where internal R&D gets paid for. It's from R&D dollars. Mm-hmm. The second category is participating inventors. We know as operating companies, when I ran licensing at Intel, we knew as an operating company what we had to do to pay for access to innovation from other participating innovators. And that was filing our own patents so we would have something to trade, buying patents so we would have something to trade. For example, Google's purchase of Motorola was out and out announced. I mean, Google has publicly affirmed that a major driver of that transaction was getting access to a patent portfolio it could use to trade with other innovators in the smartphone world. You know, strategic alliances and good old-fashioned inertia were ways to handle that innovation problem. Really, this whole debate about NPEs, the third round of patent reform in Congress, the heavy influence of the courts, the administrative agencies getting involved, are all around the fact that when I started in the IP business in the late 80s, the cost for access to patents from non-participating innovators was essentially zero. And it was essentially zero because it costs a lot of money to get access to the courts. So what do I mean? Well, look, if you have a choice as an operating company between paying nothing for access to an innovation and paying something more than nothing, the answer is obviously I'd rather pay nothing. Right? Mm-hmm. It is not illegal to violate a patent. It's not illegal to breach a contract, right? We all learn this in law school. It's apparently not immoral to violate a patent as well. So the only relevant question for an operating company who's making use of innovation from that third category, the non-participating entity, is what are you going to do to make me pay you something? That is, in 23 years of being in the licensing business, I have yet to be involved in a negotiation where the operating company being accused of using a patented invention seeks to understand whether or not they are doing that. They are making use of that technology, number one. Number two, the process for determining or solving that dispute, that is the inventor saying, yes, you are, and the operating company saying, no, I'm not, the only process available, unfortunately, is the courts. And so when you say a non-practicing entity's sole existence is to sue somebody for patent infringement, what we're really saying is, if you have a patent and somebody is refusing to give you to engage in a licensing negotiation with you under the context of, well, free is better, you really have only one tool, which is access to the courts. And we can go into this a little bit deeper in a few minutes, but in the end, the reason why these classic non-practicing entities, as you define them, are these what I call patent investors. So they're okay. Giving you the name.
Okay.
the reason that these patent investors have showed up in the marketplace is the second oldest business transaction, which is arbitrage. Mm-hmm. Right? These patents are worth more than nothing. The large operating companies are paying the inventors nothing. You therefore have a difference in value between what the inventors are getting, which is nothing, and what they're worth, which is more than nothing. And these patent investors walk in and play an arbitrage role. They give the inventors something, and they have both the economic resources and business acumen and experience necessary to force the operating companies to pay something. So one of the reasons why they're so scary is, boy, I'd rather negotiate with an inventor for whom this is his one and only negotiation with me than I would someone who's well-funded and experienced, and thus the pejorative. We have to ridicule or put into the corner those people who are arbitraging this business, because otherwise we're going to spend a lot of time having to negotiate with well-funded, sophisticated people.
We're chatting with Ron Epstein of Epicenter IP on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture and to make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, we hope that you continue to keep listening. All right, Ron. So, again, out of respect, I will use the name Patent Investors for the remainder of the interview because I do think we need to define, at least use a name somehow so that we know what we're talking about. But sure. let me ask you a few questions along those lines. And this really does get into, I think, the meat of the concerns, but also hopefully a greater understanding of what patent investors do. So a big aspect, I think, of the challenge of understanding, this part of the IP world is the fact that you or your clients or others are owning patents that themselves may be problematic from the get-go. In other words, as you know, there's been an enormous concern that too many inventions or too many patent applications are granted on inventions or claims that are not patentable for one reason or another. They're not novel, or they're obvious extensions of the prior art, which is a fancy way of saying they're really not worth giving someone monopoly for because they're not that great. And because of the issuance of these patents, there is a concern that these patents that are bad, quote-unquote, are now being used to block other entities from inventing and bringing products to market and so forth. How do you respond to the bad patents problem? Or do you even buy the bad patent problem?
Well, there are clearly lots of bad patents and for lots of understandable and not so understandable reasons. But, you know, let me address the second part of your question, which is to what extent are these bad patents blocking innovation, or they're mm-hmm. blocking innovation? My response to that is balderdash. And I'm using a deliberately archaic word to fully share my view of that. Okay. I worked in the tech industry for 20 some odd years. The number of times I saw somebody engage in a patent clearance effort before bringing back a product to market is zero. Okay, it does not happen. So to say that people are not investing in bringing their new idea to the market for fear there's someone else who might have a patent on them, I'm sure we can empirically find an occasional person who might have done that. But by and large, I would simply point out that the speed of innovation continues to accelerate, notwithstanding the patent battles that are going on. For example, the most heavily patent litigated area in tech business today is the smartphone, and yet I would challenge anyone to tell me that it would be possible that the smartphone evolution could be any faster than it already is. So there's little in the way of empirical proof on that front. That said, are there bad patents? Absolutely. There are absolutely bad patents. There are lots of reasons for that. People write patents and people don't pay enough money or a time or attention to the drafting of the patent application. People don't do prior art searches when they write these patent applications. By the way, if you were to ask me from my experience, having seen thousands and thousands of patents transacted, where you tend to see those faults occur more often, here's my challenge. To associate bad patents with a type of patent owner is just a false alignment. What do I mean? It isn't the NPE's patent investor community that is the source of bad patents. There are bad patents. My experience is that it's the patents coming from large companies who, you know, are filing hundreds if not thousands of patents a year, who tend to write the lower quality patents on the smaller inventions with the less prior art analysis. But let's agree there are bad patents. In fact, the way I like to describe it to folks is there's a patent quality spectrum. On when the end of the patent quality spectrum is crap, right? Bad patents. On the other end is "oh crap," which is what you say when you see them. And just as an aside, I was off assisting a company, ADC, in the sale of their patent portfolio on a technology called OFDM, which is the radio technology behind 4G, mm-hmm. LTE. And we were in a room with some engineers from a large cell phone company who remain nameless for the moment. But these are guys who actually sat on the committees drafting the 4G spec. And we're showing them our patents, and the engineer who was actually the chair of the committee actually said, "Oh, crap." It was a very, very life-affirming moment for me. So, you know, in terms of the numbers, you know, if you look at a volume distribution across that spectrum from crap to oh, crap, obviously the vast majority of patents are not good, right? And you get an asymptotically, you know, lower number as you approach the oh, crap. Let me just give you a statistic that makes this abundantly clear. 75% of patents are abandoned by their owners by the time the second maintenance fee is done. So what I mean by that is, if you get a patent as a patent owner, you're required to pay the patent office an additional fee after the issuance of the patent at two different time periods as a way of basically saying, I still care enough about my invention to keep the patent monopoly in force. 75% of all patents are abandoned before that second maintenance fee is paid. So patent owners themselves recognize that. So in the end, I absolutely believe we should have increased view and focus on patent quality. Who owns the patent is not even a related factor.
So if that's the case, Ron, and again, to, you know, to push back on these points, to, you know, so we have a further understanding of what's going on here, how do you respond to the follow-up criticism, which would be, well, by virtue of your activities, all you're doing, or your primary activity, and I think people like Besson and Moore have written this, maybe a couple of others, but without getting the specifics of what they've said, but generally speaking, using the phrase patent investors exacerbate the problem of bad patents by resorting to litigation, and I want to talk about licensing, which is a big part of what you do in a moment, but just focusing on these criticisms for the moment, you exacerbate these problems by giving life to these patents, which otherwise may remain on the shelf and therefore aren't enforced by their owners and therefore don't operate either as an impediment to innovation or as a way to extract rents and what have you in court costs. How do you respond to that pushback?
We're getting to the underlying question of what is necessary to support the level of innovation that we've come to expect and get used to.
Fair enough.
Underlying question, whose job is it to determine whether or not an invention is really a high-quality invention? You know, where do you draw the line? I think there's been a lot of debate recently, or a lot of proposals recently, about cost shifting and various other things to punish people who bring questionable cases. You know, I would point out there is a very clear line between bringing a case that has no merit and bringing a case that has merit and you tried hard but you lost. And particularly in a field like, you know, patents, which you know, is very complex and technology oriented, you know, there is a debate that has to be had, both, you know, what did you really mean in the patent and what is really going on in the product. And those are two separate technological, you know, conversations that need to be had. So what that means is, it's very expensive to enforce a patent. It requires someone to come up with a meaningful capital investment. The reason inventors don't typically bring the patent infringement suits themselves, and the reason I'm in business, is because very few people have millions and millions of dollars to invest in the enforcement activity. Since your sole right is to exclude, and the only forum in which you can exercise your right to exclude is a courtroom, no inventor gets to ever profit from their invention unless, A, they run into a company who, out of the goodness of their heart, is happy to pay, which I haven't run into yet in the tech industry, or B, the alternative is worse. And if you're going to deliver the alternative is worse, you have to deliver this message, which is not only do I got a patent you have to worry about, but I'm someone you're going to have to deal with. That is, I won't easily, you know, go away due to lack of funding. So once you've started this, once you've created this arbitrage economy, meaning once you've got this asset class that is worth more than the $0 it's getting and people run in, you know, you do then ultimately do then get some percentage of cases that lack merit. That is, are there mistakes made on the too many cases getting asserted? So I guess there's a balance here that has to be drawn. On one side is creating an economic system where it's next to impossible for inventors to attract the capital and expertise necessary to allow them to have a seat at the table and be respected at the table, meaning have the ability to pursue a legal remedy in the event someone refuses to negotiate with them. That's on the one end. On the other end is too many cases get brought. Traditionally in America, we settle this very firmly on the side of we want more cases to be brought than less. We want there not to be a limitation on the access to the courts, right? That's at least philosophically a view we have, that people should not be limited. Instead, we should have rules that come to a greater and quicker understanding of what is and is not meritorious and dispose of them more quickly. I think the right answer is not to adjust our courts, is not to make it harder for people to get access to the courts, but rather to be more efficient in the determination of whether or not this is a meritorious case or not.
We're chatting with Ron Epstein, CEO of Epicenter IP on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. All right, Ron, so you know, one area that I don't think gets a lot of discussion, but I think it's important to ask, are, you know, examples that you have of where patent and investors have led to products coming to market that might not otherwise, or efficiencies in the marketplace that have led to greater innovative activity. So let's talk about that. You use an example in a piece that you wrote in Bloomberg Business Week a few years ago of an entity called Fractus, and I think I'm pronouncing it correctly, but perhaps not. But perhaps you could tell us a bit about that example, perhaps other examples where your activities have led to the positive externalities that frankly I don't think get a lot of attention.
Sure. Fractus is an interesting company. They're a company based in Barcelona, Spain, founded by a very bright young physics professor from University of Catalonia, who invented a technology to make very small multiband antennas, which allow us today to have these cell phones in our pocket with, you know, multiband capability, and yet no external antenna. So this guy really invented the technology that allows you to have internal antennas and cell phones. And this technology is an example of something I and others call ingredient technologies. Ingredient technologies are technologies that make products better, make them more usable for folks, make them, you know, reach feature rich, make them more enjoyable, create greater value. But these technologies are not in and of themselves product businesses. While you can be an antenna company, the fact is 90% of all cell phone manufacturers, you know, have their own captured internal antenna technologists, right? Or in their own internal antenna manufacturing capability. And so, you know, really what we're talking about, whether it's an internal antenna in the cell phone, in the case of another famous ingredient technology company, Rambus, they invented a technology that allowed you to move data more quickly between a microprocessor and memory, which is really what drove the computer speed revolution in the 90s. Or there's another company called Tessera, again, an ingredient technology company, which invented this packaging technology called MicroBGA, which allowed us to make much higher power logic chips because this technology allowed there to be a much greater access on and off a chip of data flow. You know, these ingredient technologies can be very valuable, and the question is, where do they get innovated? Now, there's been a healthy business in Silicon Valley and elsewhere in investing R&D dollars, investing venture capital dollars, and people investing their life savings in developing these ingredient technologies, antennas, memory buses, packaging technology. And once these technologies are developed, there's an interesting phenomenon. And that phenomenon is, I guess we would call it plagiarism, stealing, copying, whatever euphemism you want to use. By that I mean, look, once an idea is in the marketplace, it is essentially free to copy that idea. There are plenty of engineers in the world, all of whom are perfectly capable. So once, in Fractus's case, engineers from Samsung saw how the technology worked, it was a relatively trivial effort for them to start designing antennas on their own using Fractus's technology. Once the marketplace saw how Rambus's technology worked, it was relatively easy to come up with an alternative, something called DDR memory, which was essentially Rambus DRAM minus two features, right? It's a very simple process. In many ways, in fact, not only is it costless to copy, it's actually cheaper to copy because, you know, if you're going to have to bring a product to market anyway, you're going to have engineers develop some kind of solution. By copying other people's, you know, ideas, you end up saving the experimental cost of the research part of R&D. So given the low cost, what happens? What happens is that these inventors of ingredient technologies may get one or two or three early adopters of their technology who voluntarily take licenses to this technology. But everybody else basically falls into the category of, yeah, you want me to pay for that? You and what army? So I've explained this to folks, including folks at the FTC, and they're somewhat resistant to the idea. But you know, I'll give you a great example. I was at Intel when Intel negotiated a license agreement with Rambus to use Rambus's memory bus, and we wanted to use it because Intel wanted to use it because it would increase the speed of PCs by making faster communication between memory and microprocessor. Mm-hmm. We took a license. One or two memory manufacturers took a license. The rest of the memory manufacturers said, listen, I don't know whether Rambus invented this or not, but I'm perfectly capable of coming up with an alternative technologically. Why should I pay Rambus for having developed it? Leaving aside that a lot of the innovation that they ended up putting in their alternative came from Rambus. Mm-hmm. So that left Rambus Tessera was left in the position, and Fractus was left in the position of, once the one or two early people, you know, who took a license took it, everyone else started copying, but they were left without an opportunity to get a fair return on the innovation they brought to the marketplace. Fractus invented this technology that is now ubiquitous in the mobile world, which is these new geometric ways of designing antennas that allow you to have this great antenna. Now, without a patent portfolio, Fractus would not have been paid anything. Mm-hmm. As it turns out, we didn't seek outside, you know, funding from patent investors. Instead, we got other more traditional investors to invest. But bottom line is, Fractus was left in a position with a patent portfolio after they had to fire their hundreds of employees and shut down their factories once the antennas were being manufactured directly by the cell phone manufacturers. And they needed access the only way. And I was the guy who walked into the Samsungs and LGs and Apples and Motorola's of the world and asked them to negotiate and take a license. And let me tell you, the entire discussion ended up being around, what do your patents say? What excuses do I have, meaning the infringers have, for violating the patent, and really an assessment by those infringers on whether or not they'd be able to, you know, get away with paying nothing. And so why do patent investors exist? Why do people like I as market makers exist? And the answer is that for the most part, innovators, you know, need access to this expertise. And then need access to the expertise in the marketplace, and then to what extent does the patent system and all of its complexity, upsides and downsides, exist? ultimately because of folks like Fractus and Tessera and Rambus. Leave aside all the emotional nonsense associated with those companies. They're true innovators, and they've got to have an ability to get a return on their investment for these ingredient technologies. Without a patent system, ingredient technology companies would not be able to successfully monetize their technology.
So, Ron, we have about five, well, even less, maybe about 4 minutes left, which is now well into what I call the unfair portion of the show, where I ask you questions that you can't possibly answer adequately in the time that we have. So this is my nod towards my radio brethren who unfortunately, because of time constraints, need to do this every day and with every interview. So you made quick mention of licensing, which I think obviously is key to how Epicenter and other patent investors operate. I do want to ask you, given what's going on right now, perhaps you could offer your opinion with regard to the proposals or any of the proposals that you'd like to mention coming out of Washington to address patent investors. And again, unfair question because I'm asking you to do this in about 3 minutes. What's your take on the current round of reforms that we briefly mentioned earlier in terms of their efficacy and what people are talking about? Any opinions there?
Well, bottom line is, I have a lot of thoughts. This is
yes.
The unfair section.
Oh, yes.
This is the unfair section.
Oh, I wasn't kidding.
I am both shocked and appalled that we are seeing such rapid evolution at the congressional and court and administrative level. You know, patent monetization, patent investors as a field is something that showed up in the marketplace in 2007, 2008. I mean, what is that, five or six years ago? Usually we let markets try and solve their own problems before we start asking the government to get involved and regulate to change that. And I have to tell you, in the 6 years, I have seen an awful lot of market evolution. There was a point when you could monetize any crappy patent that came down the mark. There was and has continued to be a progressive movement towards quality. I think that we should be more circumspect in taking repeated. I think this is we're in the third round of patent reform since 2007. It's an awful lot of fiddling with a system without letting us see what the ramifications of those fiddling are. There's obvious reasons why that's going on. Companies with large lobbying budgets are lobbying. But that said, we're in an awful danger of unintended consequence. I mean, U.S. has been the most innovative, country in the world, and I would for a very long time, in part because we are the one country that had a patent system focused on individual inventors instead of large companies. I think we would be well served to be aware of the law of unintended consequence and spend a little less time fiddling with the system and giving the market a little more time to figure out where it stands vis-a-vis the changes that have already been implemented.
Ron Epstein of Epicenter IP, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. I want to close with a last short question, which is this, and I think it relates, and it's one involving disclosure. The last round of patent reforms diminished the disclosure requirements in patents by eliminating the best mode requirement, which was theoretically designed to require the claimant to explain the best way to implement their invention, and there's a debate about how much that really told us, but be that may, that's not there. There also seems to be, at least in early belief, that because of the first-to-file change, there will be less quality in the patents because claimants are going to want to get to the PTO as early as possible. All that's by way of saying, in the scheme of what you as a patent investor view as important for innovation, getting back to that question, again, unfair question because I'm going to ask you to respond to this in about 30 seconds. How important is disclosure? I mean, how important in the innovative process do you think patent disclosure is?
Well, the advice I give inventors who come and ask me at the patent creation stage, oftentimes they come to me long after the patents exist, in my opinion, is sort of irrelevant. But those who come to me in the innovation stage, I am a huge, huge proponent of as much disclosure as humanly possible. It's only to the benefit of inventors. I think it's to the benefit of the economy. You, as an inventor, should describe what the heck it is you invented, and you should do it in detail, and which will give you the opportunity when and if such a day arrives that other people make use of it and you're having to enforce your patents. Having all that disclosure in your patent helps us all more clearly identify what the patent really says. I agree that while a lot of people have said patent quality is very important, they've nonetheless advocated things like first to file and these disclosure requirements. And in fact, a proposal a few years ago that was knocked aside on constitutional grounds to limit the number of patent continuations. All of these things, I think, were heavily focused on reducing patent quality, not improving them. So my view is a good inventor, someone who really believes and actually did invent something, more disclosure is better.
Rod Epstein, CEO of Epicenter IP, thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture and giving us your perspective on patent investors. And I look forward to continuing our conversations and having you on the show in the future to continue the discussion. Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We have a number of guests coming up on Hearsay Culture's schedule. We are in week two of the summer quarter. The way that the summer works for me is that I have most of the shows scheduled. I'm still putting that schedule together as guests, as the host, as a lot of people do take vacations in the summer, so it's a little more challenging to get people scheduled in a timely fashion. I expect to have the schedule posted this coming week, so as this show is airing on July 10th. I expect that by Friday, July 12th, you will have a schedule up, and so I will reserve laying out the guests until then. Meanwhile, though, I will mention again, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. This quarter on KZSU's schedule, you can listen at 2 p.m. Pacific Time Wednesdays by tuning in at KZSU or by streaming it at kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also get the show via podcast by going to Stanford Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu or by going to the iTunes engine for the Center for Internet Society. And you can also go to hearsayculture.com where you can get all 180-plus previous shows as well as the upcoming schedule. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. So thank you for listening today to Hearsay Culture. Please stay tuned for more diverse programming and have a great day.